As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
It's Straight Outta Cobham, a show about Chelsea FC from The Athletic. On this episode, Havertz to the rescue against Newcastle, Kerr to the rescue against Villa, we talk the latest developments on sanctions and takeovers and round up the rest of the Chelsea news. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic, this is Straight Outta Cobham. Here we are again then, listener, the first of our double dose of Chelsea podcasting goodness for the week. Joining me, Matt Davis-Adams, R2 of The Athletic's Chelsea Experts. Hello, Simon Johnson.
Hello.
And Dominic Fifield is also with us. Hi, Dom.
Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
All right, thanks. Yeah, and I think that it is high time that we started this podcast talking about a football match. Admittedly, not a very good one, but a successful one. We'll break down the win against Newcastle next.
Oh, here's Havertz. Go stick in! And finishing absolutely beautifully. It was going to take something special to unlock this Newcastle defence.
I feel that they deserve. Maybe the other coach does not feel the same way. But listen, we showed again mentality and we needed that one quality pass, a quality run, and what a quality finish from Kai.
Chelsea 1, Newcastle United 0, then a pretty atrocious game of football for 89 minutes until Kai Havertz illuminated a grey afternoon with a brilliant touch and finish from Jorginho's pass to give the Blues a fifth league win in a row. Here's a tweet from Richard Carter who says, even if at Chelsea FC is sold overnight to a Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk-led consortium, I still expect an opening Havertz appreciation monologue from Liam Toomey on the Straight Outta Cobham podcast. Sorry, Richard, Liam isn't on today, but I feel certain he's delivering said monologue to his wife, daughter and dog as we speak. After a seismic week at Stamford Bridge, we sent one of our senior writers down to the game yesterday to take in the sights and sounds around the stadium on a day when the game between Chelsea and Newcastle was completely overshadowed by greater geopolitical issues.
Hello, this is George Culkin. I'm outside Stamford Bridge, not too long before Chelsea play Newcastle. I've been here for a few hours wandering around trying to sort of get to grips with today and what it means and what it doesn't mean. There's a feeling of normal abnormality, I'd call it. It feels like a normal match day in lots of ways. There's lots of fans milling around. It's very, very busy. At the same time, it's not quite the same as it always is. On the tube on the way over, there was a Chelsea fan with his son there, and his son said, oh, what's going to happen today, Dad? And the older fella said, we're going to f***ing smash him like we always do. So it does feel normal in that sense. But there's small pockets of protests around. There's lots of media doing interviews with Chelsea fans and the Chelsea Supporters Trust are here too. I've bumped into Liam, our brilliant Chelsea writer. What do you make of the atmosphere here today, Liam?
Honestly, it doesn't look any different to Chelsea home games that I've been to before. You know, there are people just milling around. You're not hearing like endless choruses of Roman Abramovich. I've heard it a couple of times. There was one quite interesting moment as I was coming out of Fulham Broadway Station where a guy in front of me with his kid got out his phone, smiling to sort of take a selfie video of the fans behind him singing, you are my Chelsea, my only Chelsea, and then they immediately switched to Roman Abramovich. He put his phone away again. So that I think that moment kind of sums up the fact that there's not really a universal feeling here. I think a lot of fans are still figuring out what they make of what's happened in the last 2 weeks, and I think they will be for a little while. I'm fully expecting, once I'm in the stadium, to hear chants in support of Abramovich. We've just got some Newcastle fans going by in spirits.
I mean, that's one of the other interesting bits about today, is that you've got old new money meets new money, and you've got a club in Newcastle who are obviously riding the crest of a wave of a team suddenly doing well, having spent a load of money in January, and with new ownership, which kind of poses a lot of the same sort of questions that Chelsea are going through at the moment.
Yeah, in many ways, it's, depending on which way you look at it, the perfect or the worst possible opponent, given developments at Chelsea for the whole sort of geopolitical narrative around the Premier League as a whole. I mean, there's obviously been lots written and talked about this week about the compare and contrast between Newcastle's owners and Roman Abramovich, and I think that will continue to be a theme. It might even be a theme between the two sets of fans in the stadium, because we know that, you know, generally once fans get into that environment, everything is game for point scoring, for better or worse.
And it's, I mean, when I sort of mentioned that sort of normal abnormality, you can get more of a sense of it, I think, when you get closer to the stadium, because there's no programmes on sale today. The club shop is closed. You know, they're advertising a sale in the club shop, but nobody can get in. The club museum is open, but only for people who've pre-booked tickets.
Over there for Chelsea versus Brentford with no tickets available written underneath it, which is, you know, quite unusual for a game to be advertised, but they're not advertised in terms of ticket sales.
And you still see sort of big hoardings with three Chelsea sponsors who have kind of walked away, but they haven't gone, they're still there. So it's only really when you sort of stop and stare and really think about it that you sort of notice any kind of meaningful difference.
Yeah, and that actually kind of highlights, as much as anything, the holding pattern, the strange holding pattern that Chelsea are in now, because three have stepped away, but they haven't walked away. You know, they've suspended their partnership. So have Hyundai, who do the training kit. But they're sort of waiting, like everyone else, to see what happens next with Chelsea. And I think we all expect there to be significant developments in the next week or two in the ownership with regards to a sale. And then, of course, these brands might reevaluate their positions when the time comes. But for now, it is definitely part of the sort of surreal aesthetic of this game.
So we're approaching kickoff now. Fans pouring in through the Stamford Gate. This is where the away fans are coming in. They're the people we can hear, but I don't think that's particularly unusual. The away fans are always the fans making the noise. And still, it feels like a pretty normal match day experience to me. The one thing that does feel strange is the number of media outlets and media people. I realise I'm one of those, so there's an irony in me saying that. But approaching Chelsea fans to comment on the situation regarding their club and Russia and Ukraine and Abramovich, that feels very peculiar. But the rest of it doesn't at the moment. It really doesn't. So anyway, we'll see what it's like on the inside. Standing outside Stamford Bridge, the last few people are kind of dribbling out the stadium now after Chelsea's 1-0 win. I don't know what I expected today. I think maybe I expected it to feel different, and it hasn't really felt different. There have been some, you know, chants from Newcastle fans inside the stadium, as you've heard, but I mean, that's very much par for the course. The way it feels to me is it's business as unusual. It's not quite the same, but really football rolls on, doesn't it? And that's certainly how it felt today. No real kind of great difference outside the stadium, apart from people like me wandering around, journalists, and certainly no difference inside, except perhaps that big moment of relief and release for Chelsea when they scored their winning goal. But yeah, football rolls on, money rolls on.
George Culkin and Liam Toomey there. Simon, Newcastle came for a point, didn't they? A fact reflected by the fact that it took Chelsea, 75 minutes to have a shot on target? They almost managed it, but it was that one moment of brilliance right at the end that settled it in Chelsea's favour.
Yeah, it was always going to be a tough game for many reasons. Obviously, the circumstances Chelsea were playing in, but also Newcastle are in a good run of form, had been unbeaten in 2022, and that's why they're sort of climbing away to safety quite comfortably. Chelsea laboured for long periods. They looked. It reminded me very much of the Chelsea Brighton game in April last year, which was played in the backdrop of the European Super League fiasco, minds elsewhere. Chelsea players didn't play with the same kind of freedom, and it felt like they were playing with a lot on their minds. As well as Newcastle played, it looked like they were lacking intent, sort of. They just didn't see themselves, but they had to rely on a bit of luck as well with the referee. And then quickly, well, it shouldn't be talked about quickly. There was one moment of that just was not befitting of the game. We're talking world-class quality. And Kai Havertz is getting most of the attention, and rightly so, because his touch and finish was sublime. But Jorginho's pass, I've always wanted more from Jorginho in a creative sense. He does play a lot of safe passes, but this was just an absolute peach of a pass. It perfectly weighted and flighted over Dan Burn's head, which allowed Havertz the chance to sort of touch and finish ahead of Dubravka before he could get there. A brilliant moment which was so needed for everyone at the club. Yes, they'd won at Norwich on Thursday night, but this really felt like a gift that everyone associated with Chelsea needed.
Dom, Peter Crouch said that there were shades of Dennis Bergkamp in the Havertz goal for him. Would you agree with that? I thought there were maybe shades of Fabregas in the pass as well.
Yeah, really, really good analogies, both of those. I mean, that is completely fair. I mean, the way that Jorginho, he's exchanging the passes with Rudiger and then just working the space. And we talk quite often about how build-up play can be quite laboured, but there was a purpose to that. He was toying the space out of Longstaff, I think it was, and the last pass he plays to Rudiger, he then backpedals 5 yards so that he's got that space in front of him where he can look up and find that gorgeous Fabregas-esque pass diagonal beyond Burn for Havertz to collect. An absolutely sublime pass, as Si says. But the touch with his outstretched left foot to gather and then the speed at which he gets the shot away to leave Dubravka completely flat-footed, that was Bergkamp-esque. That really was. It was akin to, I think it was against Newcastle and Leicester. He used to score these sublime goals all the time, wasn't it? I mean, they must be wondering what the people have got against them, Newcastle United. But it was a moment of genius amidst plenty of huff and puff. Chelsea have been playing like this for a while. I know we say they sort of always got mitigating circumstances given everything that's happened in the last week. But I thought that was a pretty similar performance to the one against Palace, really. Threatening to take control, but never really being completely in command of the situation. And then in the dregs of the game, it was Ziyech on that occasion who came up with a fantastic finish. And now we've got Havertz doing the same against Newcastle. I mean, I think it's almost becoming a great habit to have. If you're not going to be playing scintillating stuff, you just want to be grinding out your wins. And your meaningful, world-class flashes of genius are winning you the points. And that's what Chelsea have done on a couple of occasions in recent weeks.
One similarity between the game on Sunday and the Crystal Palace game was the referee, David Coote. His dad used to be a cricketer for Nottinghamshire, but it was Newcastle who were left asking, how's that, after penalty appeals.
Get out. Get out now.
Bowling middle stump out the ground.
I hadn't even written that down, by the way. That was an ad-lib. So, that's what you get for your athletic subscription.
Jeez.
Simon, was it one of those where the sort of poor decisions evened themselves out, or actually a Newcastle right to feel aggrieved that A, Jacob Murphy didn't get a penalty, and before that Kai Havertz wasn't sent off?
I think I'd be disappointed he didn't go to the third umpire.
Enough.
You've lost half the audience.
Right, let's deal with one incident at a time. So let's start with Havertz's elbow on Dan Byrne. It's one of those you've definitely seen them given as red cards, but as Havertz explained afterwards, there were mitigating circumstances in terms of Dan Byrne's height.
I liked him. Yeah, the line he used was great, wasn't it?
He said he was 7-8 feet tall.
And two head heights higher than me.
and in fairness, Danny Murphy on Match of the Day highlighted where Dan Byrne's elbow was, which was actually just below Havertz's chin in a very similar swinging motion. So that essentially they were both doing the same thing. It's just that Havertz's elbow connected with Dan Byrne's temple. Yes, orange card, if I'm being generous. And I do accept Havertz's explanation that it wasn't intentional. Because you can see on the replay that at no point is he looking at Dan Byrne. It's not a classic, oh, I'm looking to do him. It was in the motion of jumping to win the header. The penalty, though, is a different story. It was one of those where watching it, you instantly sort of went, oh, dear. You know, you're waiting for the decision to be made. Bizarrely, he gave a corner, which was arguably it was just as baffling as not giving a penalty. But the replays confirmed what you sort of saw first time around. You know, Chalobah had completely panicked as Murphy was dribbling, grabbed hold of his shirt and held on to it for quite a long time, actually, a few seconds. Yes, Murphy, you could argue, perhaps sort of right at the end decided to fall over to probably sort of do that classic try and get the decision. But yeah, Chelsea did get away with one there. But they could argue, well, perhaps they're owed one from the League Cup final. That's perhaps the way they'd see it.
Dom, Thomas Tuchel's subs, by and large, paid off. He said that it took some big balls to bring Pulisic on and put him at wing-back. I thought actually Kovacic was maybe the most impactful in terms of that running from midfield that he was able to do that Kante and Jorginho struggled with. But another ineffective cameo from Romelu Lukaku, kind of underlined by the fact that it was Havertz who got the goal. If Lukaku can't even be an impact sub, then that really is a big problem.
Yeah, we're sort of covering old ground, aren't we? I mean, it's a difficult one, and we've had the same conversation about Timo Werner as well. You know, at the very least, you'd expect them to make an impact off the bench, the very, very least, and they've struggled to do that this season. And Lukaku of late. On the other changes, they obviously having to. There's a bit of a makeshift feel to that back line with Chalobah playing it. Right back, and the switches. I mean, Pulisic has worked at wing back on occasion. He's also been ineffective at times as well. But he's almost at the point where you may as well try it. He's actually been playing really well, and obviously I think it was an illness, wasn't it, in the week that had prevented him featuring at Norwich. So at least you're bringing on a player that's got a bit of confidence at the moment and playing well, and against a team that was sitting back and, as you say, looking for a point at best. Kovacic, I'm almost surprised that he doesn't play more often. He's one of the best players in this team, in this squad. And I know they have loads of options in that midfield area. And it's, you know, I still find it difficult when Kante's left out, because you just look at him and think, well, you know, he's liable to be a world beater any moment. He could just, you know, he's all the old form will come flooding back. But Kovacic has been consistently excellent with those driving runs. He's found his shooting boots almost this season as well, which has been a bit of an added bonus. And he just looks like the proper combative midfielder who will drive you on in difficult situations. So, I mean, it's a great option to have off the bench. But I'd imagine that he should be starting more games than he's coming off the bench in, to be honest. But you know, difficult balancing act with the amount of games that Chelsea have to play. And yeah, at some point the Lukaku issue will will come back into focus as well up top. I mean, given the last few weeks, I imagine that returning to that debate, you know, where the hell we fit him in, is probably something that most Chelsea fans would welcome.
Absolutely. Speaking of the Chelsea fans, Liam's post-match piece for The Athletic mentions that there wasn't much in terms of chanting for Roman Abramovich, and when it was quickly shushed down. Quite a surprise, Simon, to see the Roman Empire banner still up. That felt in quite poor taste to me.
Yeah, it was. I can only assume, and sort of in their defence, that maybe in the sort of stress of the last few days, they just haven't got around to that sort of the banners that are always there. They haven't got round to looking at and going, oh yeah, perhaps we should take that one away. It is pretty embarrassing that it's been left up. I'm sure it's been removed or will be removed now. But yeah, it was very clumsy. Yeah, wasn't the best thing. But I do want to sort of quickly touch on the fans, really, because it's kind of following, or maybe I should just get Lucy to talk about it. As requested by someone on Twitter, wasn't it? But I do sort of think, okay, it's time to give fans a bit of a break here. There does seem to be this determination to tar everyone with the same brush. Not everyone is chanting Roman Abramovich's name. Not everyone is blind to the effects, to what's going on in Ukraine. It does seem that sort of Chelsea fans are getting hit left, right and centre as like the worst people on earth. And at this point in time, you just sort of have to think, well, forget Abramovich, and in the nicest possible way, in this probably clumsy phrase, forget the connections with what's going on elsewhere. Football clubs, as we've seen during COVID, they are huge for people's mental health. It gives people a break from sort of perhaps what's going on in their personal lives. It's something that they look forward to. It's a chance to meet with friends. It's a chance to have a break from perhaps something else. And so to constantly hammer Chelsea fans as the worst thing in the world and delight in the club's downfall, I just sort of think that just bear in mind that, you know, there are people that, okay, that may not be the worst element of Chelsea's fan base and just love football like we all do on this podcast. And they're right to be feeling a little bit upset with what's going on. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, well said. Well, Chelsea are back in action in the Champions League on Wednesday. We'll preview that game later. Next today, the latest on the off-the-pitch situation.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I have to admit that we go day by day, as I said, because we don't have this in our hands, and the conversations are going on that we can actually, you know, operate the way that we can finish the season, because obviously it's a difficult situation, and as well we are a part of the Premier League and one of the best competitions in the world, and I believe that you know, for us to be able to carry on to finish the season would obviously help everybody involved in the Premier League too.
There's Petr Cech. Before the Newcastle game, he spoke to Sky Sports about the situation surrounding the sanctions placed on the club. Simon, do we know why it was him who was wheeled out? It was a good exercise in saying not very much, which in fairness to Cech, I suspect he doesn't actually know very much, but it felt like something that, that Chelsea sort of needed to do without really wanting to give anything away?
I just think it was kind of like he was the best that wasn't a board member but could articulate sort of what's going on a little bit whilst effectively saying the same thing as Thomas Tuchel. Like Cech is very good at talking to the media. He's been doing it most of his life, obviously, as a goalkeeper. He did a briefing out in Abu Dhabi during the Club World Cup. Perhaps before all this was happening, he was starting to be moulded into a sort of that kind of spokesman for the club kind of role as part of his duties. You could tell as he was talking, he was feeling the tension, the nerves of what he was allowed to say. But I thought it was very important just for someone other than Thomas Tuchel to be talking to effectively to the fans, you know, forget sort of the media and everyone else. I think it's important that someone that's got some kind of connection, he's obviously very close with Marina Granovskaya, who was seen sat next to during the game, that there was an element of here's another voice to sort of say this is what's going on, even though he didn't actually, as is true, they don't know what's going on really. So it was an important exercise for Chelsea supporters to hear from someone else.
Roman Abramovich disqualified as a director by the Premier League on Saturday. I mean, they've been really mealy-mouthed about this, haven't they, Dom? This feels like almost a meaningless thing to have happened after the sanctions, after the fact that the club's effectively been taken off him. Do you think the Premier League have handled this well? Do you think they were right to let the government deal with it? Should we have heard more from them? Or does that just open them up to further scrutiny and questions about not just Abramovich, but other owners in the Premier League as well?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there with that last bit. They've been running away from this issue for a long, long time. They must have dreaded the imposition of sanctions on Chelsea because it does open a can of worms. As we've discussed before on the podcast, unprecedented situation in as much as the war prompting it. But actually, it's cast even more scrutiny onto subsequent deals that have been waved through by the Premier League that apparently cleared their owners and directors tests and quite rightly are now being looked at, and people are wondering quite how that happened. And you know, the irony that they were playing Newcastle United on Sunday is lost on nobody. The actual disqualification of Abramovich as a director is, I think, purely just a box-ticking exercise. It had to happen because he's been sanctioned by the UK government, and therefore that means that he can't be considered to be a fit and proper person anymore to run a football club. So it didn't really mean anything. And I think that there was a natural... When that was announced on Saturday morning, I suspect from the outside looking in, the natural assumption was, oh my word, this is another crisis for Chelsea. Things are getting even gloomier, and it's a disaster, etc., etc. But actually, I thought a lot of the stuff that happened on Saturday was a lot more positive, and it's probably the start of a process that will lead to Chelsea being taken over sooner rather than later. New ownership, the first review, because I suspect there'll be other reviews of the license, offering a bit more leeway in terms of. How much money Chelsea can spend on a match day, for example, going up from £500,000 to £900,000. That's quite significant. That's the first indication that the government and the Treasury are willing to be slightly more fluid on the terms of that licence. The first announced on the 10th of March last Thursday and then reviewed on the 12th. I suspect there'll be more further reviews of that in terms of ticketing, because Chelsea needs to get some kind of revenue streams into that club to allow them some kind of operational revenues that will allow them to pay the wages. The government do not want a situation where Chelsea are completely kiboshed by the license, or sorry, by the sanction rather, and don't have the means of meeting the payroll. So I suspect that will move again this week. And in terms of the ownership itself, Rain Group, the merchant bank in New York, I think, who is dealing with the sale, have written to interested parties and have told them to put details of their bids in before Friday, the 18th. They're anticipating four or five, I imagine, coming forward, and it's not quite a secret auction. I suspect that there will be a bit of discussion from Rain with interested bidders, sort of letting them know that, you know, you're falling short in this area, or you might want to up this bit to make a more acceptable offer. But I think that process will now lead to maybe next week, 10 days, you get a preferred buyer, and then maybe in a month's time, Chelsea will be under new ownership, and it won't look the same. It won't be the same, arguably, as it was under Abramovich, but at least it'll be on a stable footing again and the club can progress.
Well, Nick Candy's one of those who have declared their interest. He was pounced upon by Sky's Gary Cottrell as he made his way into Stamford Bridge yesterday. This is what he had to say.
Just wondering how it's going.
It's going good.
Why do you want to own Chelsea? Just a message for the fans.
I've supported Chelsea since the age of four. My dad was asked to play for Chelsea. I love Chelsea. I don't mind where it ends up, even if it's not with me, as long as it's in safe hands.
It needs to be in safe hands. The fans need to be involved in the ownership.
100%. Yeah, they should be involved in the ownership, both on the board and economically.
How long will it take to sort out, do you think?
Friday's best bids.
Seems to have been doing a lot of talking, Simon, through his spokesman over the weekend. Do you have a preferred bidder? Say, let's put you in the position of the person who's deciding the sale. Do you need to know more about the people who are involved? Do you think it's likely to be somebody you haven't heard anything from yet, as is sometimes the case in these kind of situations?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there are people that we haven't heard from, because I'm very cynical about people putting themselves out in the media spotlight before anything's remotely been done, etc. As for a preferred bidder, the only thing that I'm sort of thinking of Chelsea wise is just ideally someone that's not connected to a conflict. That'd be good. someone, you know, who can't be looked at 19 years down the line and sort of punished. I just think that this is just important for everyone to get right, not just Chelsea. Like, it's important that whoever comes in, their money is beyond reproach and can be used by Chelsea to get things back, as Dom says, on an even keel.
I'm actually intrigued as to who makes the final decision, because technically, yeah, Roman Abramovich shouldn't make the final decision. These interested parties will effectively be buying Chelsea FC from Fordstam, which was Abramovich's company. It's only listed, it's got two directors at the moment, an accountant called Paul Hegren, who's based in Surrey, and Eugene Tenenbaum, who obviously is very close to Roman Abramovich, a financier. I think he lives on Jersey, I think, at the moment. Is that right, Si? I think that is. But beyond that, I think it's Camberley International that own Fordstam. And although we don't technically know who owns Camberley, the assumption was always that it was Abramovich, as it should be, given that it was his club. So who is making this final decision? Is it Rain? Have Rain just been told, you just do it, just buy Abramovich, just go and sell it to anyone? Who makes a decision as to which of these bidders has got the best interests of Chelsea Football Club at heart? Because that's what the fans will want to know, surely. That they'll want to know that this is going to be in safe hands now. But that's intriguing. Is it the government? Do the government have a say in it all? I mean, it's with the greatest of respect, actually with no respect whatsoever towards the British government, you wouldn't want them making that decision, would you? But yeah, the other bit of good news is the fact that Rain were able to tell bidders that the process had restarted again was an indication that Roman Abramovich isn't going to fight this sanction legally, I think, which we spoke about again last week, which would have had grim implications for Chelsea. I think it would have dragged on, and I imagine the licence would have been revoked eventually, and Chelsea would have really struggled to function. So that's good news. It seems that he's still intent upon selling, and yeah, we just got to hope that the person that he sells to and whoever makes that decision has got that best interest of the club at heart.
Do we know if the company credit cards have been unfrozen? That was a big story on Friday, wasn't it?
That was a temporary situation. Again, and I know this is in a sporting context, so it's all we're all sort of railing at this, and oh my word, this is incredible. They can't put petrol in the team coach. I mean, this is incredible. This is what sanctions are. This is what happens when somebody is sanctioned who owns assets, as in a company. I was speaking to people, Si and I did a piece on sanctions prior to them actually being imposed upon Roman Abramovich, and speaking to people then, there was this general sense of people don't realise what's about to happen here. The very basic things that we take completely for granted are about to stop, and they're not going to be able to do them. And one of those things is the onus is always placed on the banks to make sure that these sanctions are implemented. If something slips through the net and a transaction is completed on the bank's watch, then the bank is the one that suffers. The bank is the one that gets punished. There are massive, massive fines handed out to banks for the abuse of sanctions. So every bank or institution or, you know, a company that's in charge of a credit card at Chelsea had to conduct due diligence, which were going to take a few days, to make sure that these transactions did not slip through the net. One of those things was the credit cards. They couldn't, I mean, technically speaking, it would have been a violation of the sanction had a company credit card been used to go and put petrol in a coach. If that coach wasn't being driven to a game as part of the 20 grand limit on travel for away matches, etc. It's that the nitty gritty that it comes down to. And that is why sanctions work, because they literally freeze everything. You can't do anything. So although it was a great soundbite about the coach fuel, etc. It was always going to happen. You know, Barclaycard were always going to look at the credit card situation, and the banks were going to look at it. I imagine those credit cards will now no longer be frozen, and that they'll be able to, you know, buy the cans for the journey home, etc.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on sort of how I sort of experienced the sanctions at the under-23s game on Friday night, when, of course, for senior games, the media looked after very well. You know, here's some food, here's some tea, blah, blah, blah. It's all free. But obviously, understandably, at youth level, it's by itself, mate. And off I went to the bar, the lovely catering area, and I said, oh, I'll have a cup of tea and a pie, please. And the guy behind the bar went, it's on me. And I went, but we've only just met. and then I quickly tweaked. I went, this is because of the sanctions, isn't it? He went, yeah. Then they couldn't say, and the conversation, okay, cheesy joke aside, was pretty much had with everyone that then queued up. They went, it's free. Everyone got very excited. I think they were glad they came. Not so much for the football. But it was sort of bizarre, you know. It's kind of course, yeah. And they had to sort of get rid of the stuff because obviously it had already been bought and stuff. So, but again, it just hammered home. Well, you can't even, it would have cost, I think, I don't know, about a £5 or £6 or something. But yeah, couldn't take it.
And in the press room on Sunday, the press were gorging themselves silly, having learned the news that the catering bill had been paid in advance until the end of the season. So the famous buffet has survived for now. All right, if you want the best insight and all the details on any potential takeover, get yourself signed up for a subscription at theathletic.com/ChelseaPod. You'll pay just £1 a month for the first 6 months. Next today, we'll have a look ahead to Chelsea's Champions League tie with Lille.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
My last information is that we have a plane, but and we can go by plane and can go back by plane. If not, we go by train. If not, we go by bus. If not, I drive a seven-seater, honestly. I will do. Yeah, you can mark my words. I will do. I will arrive there.
On Wednesday night, Chelsea go to France, possibly in a seven-seater driven by Thomas Tuchel. they surely need more than seven seats for that. But anyway, it was a nice gesture from the Chelsea manager. The Blues 2-0 up from the first leg. How are you getting there, Simon?
I'm going there by Chelsea's plane, which is now... I'm booked on a Eurostar. I was very disappointed to find out that I was leaving before the players because there's part of me that thought, oh, I might be sitting with them and get a chance to sort of chat about, oh, you know, how's life under sanctions? But no, Eurostar Tuesday morning. And it's almost forgotten. Like, there's this Champions League, you know, it's... It is weird to sort of talk about football. It seems a long, long time ago since that 2-0 win at home, which normally you sort of think, oh, that's a very, very comfortable scoreline to take back to take to the away game. But with away goals not counting anymore, you only have to look at what Inter Milan were able to do at Anfield to sort of keep the tie alive, make Liverpool fans a bit nervous. So this tie isn't done and dusted. It, you know, Lille they showed enough at Stamford Bridge for Chelsea to sort of go there and sort of know that they're going to have to be put in a performance. Although Lille are without Renato Sanchez, I think he's picked up an injury and he looks very good in the first leg.
And also, Lille don't have a lot of goals in them, Dom, do they? Drew 0-0 against Saint-Étienne on Friday. Assuming that the likes of Thiago Silva will be back, Marcus Alonso, maybe even Reece James too, it's difficult to see them scoring at least twice against this Chelsea team, no?
Yeah, probably, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's they looked a bit like the Rennes team that Chelsea came up against last season in the group stage, I think. Quite physically impressive, a good physical presence up top in Onana in particular. Bamba and Sanchez was excellent at Stamford Bridge. David obviously is a player of a proper quality who's going to go places in his career. But yeah, it was more that they didn't create brilliant chances. They created lots of half chances and therefore snatched at those and didn't hurt Chelsea properly. They might be more of a threat over there. It's interesting to see that Hatem Ben Arfa, who came on at Stamford Bridge and got himself booked in a very, very late cameo, didn't really provide very much other than that, I think one shot. But he has started the last three games now and was taken off along with David just after the hour mark against Saint-Étienne at the weekend. So maybe he is more of the creative hub for Lille and the hope they can unlock Chelsea and hurt them in France. But look, 2-0 is a good solid lead to take to France against a team that I think at this level probably still feels slightly inferior. Maybe even psychologically they're not quite sure they belong in the latter stages of this competition. That's maybe a bit unfair, but it just sort of feels that they're slightly short in a lot of areas across the team, and Chelsea should be able to exploit that.
Yeah, they're sixth in Ligue 1 and a full 22 points behind PSG. Simon, I mentioned Reece James briefly there. That's good news, isn't it? It seems like he'll be back a lot quicker than we first thought.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps I should have been a bit more careful with the wording when I wrote a story last week that the initial story was he'd be out for up to 2 weeks. And yeah, then I subsequently spoke to someone else the next day and they said, oh, actually, it could be as little as 5 days to 2 weeks. It's always one of those timelines of injuries can be a little bit can always be a little bit sort of interchangeable, but it was always a minor problem. That was the good news about it, because the way Tuchel initially spoke was that he was also saying, "Oh, it's not good news," and we're sort of having to get more scans. And you sort of, as you were listening to him saying it, you're going, "Oh crikey, is he going to be out for sort of months even?" I still think they should be a little bit careful with him, because if he's picking up an injury so soon after coming back, albeit in the other leg to the one that kept him out for 2 months, it shows there is a bit of an element of fatigue from playing so much football over the last few years. So don't rush him back too soon. Is he really needed against Lille? Is he really needed against Middlesbrough? I'd certainly be tempted to treat him a bit cautiously and perhaps make sure he's 100% right, so he's good to go after the international break. So perhaps he won't start either game and will just come on for sort of 10, 15 minutes if he's ready to go.
And I guess, Dom, that would give Chelsea a little bit of leeway if he doesn't feature in these games against Lille and Borough, to say to Gareth Southgate, actually, can you not pick him for the England games and we'll give him a little bit extra rest?
Yeah, definitely. I'd be very surprised if he played much part in that international window, to be honest. I think there'll be a level of understanding there, given that he's now had muscular problems in both legs, in both hamstrings, etc. I'd fully expect Southgate to be sensible on that front. It's not as if he hasn't got other options at right wing back or right back. There are plenty of players that will be desperate to get into that England team and he'll want to have a look at. So it shouldn't be a priority to pick Reece James.
Well, whether he features or not in France on Wednesday, we will handle all the fallout of that game in our Thursday pod. Elsewhere in Chelsea news.
Kerr comes through and Kerr scores! Chelsea have done it! In the second minute of stoppage time, Sam Kerr scores a goal to keep their WSL title hopes in their own hands.
For Kai Havertz, read Sam Kerr. The Aussie scored a stoppage time winner for Chelsea against Aston Villa at Kings Meadow on Sunday. Goalkeeper Zecira Musovic got the assist. Her punt upfield pounced upon by Kerr, who'd earlier had a goal ruled out for offside. Chelsea had 22 shots in the game. The win means Emma Hayes' team keep the fate of their title in their own hands. They're 5 points behind leaders Arsenal, but with two games in hand on the Gunners. Chelsea have 7 left to play in the league, starting at Everton on Wednesday night. You can read more about the game, including the thoughts of Emma Hayes, in a piece on The Athletic penned by our friend Flo Lloyd-Hughes. And mixed news for the academy sides. The under-18s booked their place in the final of the under-18 Premier League Cup by beating Stoke 5-1. Tudor Mendele-Dowu scored twice, with Silco Thomas, Ronnie Stutter and Josh Tobin also on the score sheet to set up a final with either Leicester or Fulham. And meanwhile, as Simon mentioned, he was on hand at King's Meadow to see the under-23s draw with West Ham. Means they're still far from sure of their place in Division 1 of the PL2 for next season. Simon, you've written an extensive piece on the state of the academy. Tell us more about it, please.
Well, I hasten to add, I started working on this before all the drama of the last few days, because my interest was pricked, basically, because you just go, when have you ever heard of the under-23s being in a relegation battle? And then, of course, only a few weeks ago, the under-19s in the Youth League, a competition that Chelsea won twice and reached the final on a couple of other occasions, got a great record in, lost 5-1 at Genk. And you're going, hang on a minute, is there a problem here, or is this just a blip? Is it just one of these things? So I started talking to people, but, you know, agents that base themselves at that level of football and sort of go to a lot of games, people around the Chelsea youth system. And yeah, it's not the academy is not rubbish, you know, and I'm certainly not saying that. I'm not suddenly saying, oh yeah, it's all over, blah, blah, blah. But it's very interesting to sort of hear that sort of even within the confines of the academy that, you know, they're obviously not happy with what's going on. They're looking, before the sanctions hit, they're sort of like desperately trying to find players, but they've been hit by Brexit rules. They can no longer shop for the best players in Europe between the ages of 16 and 18. Players like Andreas Christensen, who was signed at 16, Nathan Aké, of course, now at Man City, but he was signed at 15, actually, although I don't think he technically joined till 60. Even Ian Mattson, who's currently on loan at Coventry, a player like that wouldn't be able to sign. So they've been sort of like looking at players even as far down, you know, way down in the non-league, or Jaden Wareham signed from Woking, etc. Also, it's quite interesting, they're working on a project because the caveat to the sort of element doom and gloom, the under-9s and under-12s are apparently outstanding. I don't know, I've not seen them. But this is what I've been told. They actually have got ridiculously high hopes for these age groups, and they are focusing not all their efforts, but there is a real sort of focus to make these the cream of the crop in Europe. And people also go, oh, you know, that's putting a load of pressure on them. You got to remember, this is the age when you sort of think when Reece James and Mason Mount, you know, these kids were joined at the age of 8, etc., and now they're in the first team. So it's very much that kind of thinking of sort of trying to work with these rough diamonds and sort of make them into the real deal. But anyway, it's a very complex subject. It's not all bad news, but there's definitely cause for concern.
Yeah, and just to add to that from my perspective, having seen quite a lot of both of them, I'd say that there is an element of concern with the under-23s, definitely, but the under-18s look like a much brighter crop than the current under-23 squad. So hopefully in a couple of years, it'll be back to business as usual.
Yeah, and I hasten to add, Matt, you know, of course, one of the reasons why the under-23s are also suffering a little bit and even other age groups is that, of course, players have been promoted this season to the first team squad. So instead of playing for the under-23s, they've been in the first team. So even then, you know, there are mitigating circumstances with the under-23s too.
Yeah, and you often get teams in that PL2 Division 1, like Man City and Everton, who tend to just not loan out many players. So they keep their best players, whereas Chelsea generally loan out anybody who they think's got a decent future in the game. All right, so Simon's got that up on The Athletic. We mentioned George Culkin earlier and heard from him earlier. His full piece on the experience of the game on Sunday is also up. Liam's got a big read up on the game and more. Dom, what are you working on this week?
So we've got the mailbag going up probably for Wednesday morning. Some of the questions asked by readers towards the end of last week. Actually all of them will be still current because I think we're in that position where we're just waiting for things to happen now. And I need to tackle the issue of whether the new owners of Chelsea Football Club can hope to emulate what Roman Abramovich did in terms of both trophies, but also the way he ran the club, obviously being at a debt-making, running it at a deficit, let's put it like that, and whether that's likely with new owners coming in, you know, and the implications of all that.
And Simon, after we've finished here, you're going to be jumping on the Athletic's football podcast with Mark Chapman. Presumably you'll be what? Looking at Malang Sarr's effectiveness at left back or something like that?
Kennedy piece. I hope this almost feels like let's get back to the cricket analogy. It almost feels like a net and then I'm going to have to go out and face some hostile bowling for Mark Chapman. I might have to be a bit more concise than I've been this morning on this show.
Is that a compliment or an insult to me? I'll leave it to you to decide.
Definitely not.
All right, we'll be back on Thursday when we'll go through that Lille game. Look ahead to the FA Cup quarterfinal and catch up with the women's team too. Do join us for that if you can. From all of us here, though, it's bye for now.
The Athletic.